Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
These days, I can do anything from my phone. Book a vacation, order a meal from a five-star restaurant, buy and trade stocks. But maybe the most amazing thing I can do is make my dirty laundry disappear and then reappear perfectly washed and folded. I have Rinse to thank for that. I just schedule a pickup in the Rinse app or at rinse.com. A Rinse valet comes to get my clothes, and before I know it, they're back, crisply folded and ready to wear. They even do dry cleaning, which is returned hanging in a nice Rinse garment bag. And with Rinse, my satisfaction is guaranteed. If for any reason I'm not happy, they'll re-clean my clothes for free. Best of all, Rinse saves me tons of time each week. That's time I get to do something I love versus something I have to do. So if you want to save loads of time by not doing loads of laundry, remember, there's an app for that. Rinse. Sign up now and get $20 off your first order at rinse.com. That's RINSE.com.
What up, what up, what up? Welcome, everybody, to the Man of Steel podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Yes, the Man of Steel. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. You know how that goes. And also, you can follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Well, I thought, you know, as we got past Thanksgiving and we'd have, you know, sort of that tryptophan high kind of sort of lingering there in the background and in the belly. You just kind of have a nice quiet moment. So I figured I'd call up a brother who I've known a long time, and we could just have a nice leisurely conversation about, you know, the world and maybe a little politics. And, well, all hell's broken loose yet again in this land of Trump. And I'm glad I've got Matt Lewis with us to sort of dig into the latest level of crazy. Matt K. Lewis is a senior columnist at The Daily Beast. I follow him over there and on Twitter. He's a CNN political commentator and the author of Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. It's an excellent pickup, folks. You got to get your read on with this book over the holidays, because it gives you some insights into how crazy got crazier. Matt, welcome to the podcast, man.
Hey, Chairman. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So, I like I said, I thought we'd just kind of have like a nice little, you know, L-tryptophan kind of, you know, or tryptophan conversation around, you know, post-Thanksgiving. But that's not how it plays out in Washington today in the land of Trump, where, you know, we're seeing yet again those closest to the president figuring out that the loyalty is a one-way street with him. And no matter how much he kind of dangles this idea of a pardon in front of them, you know, guys like Michael Cohen just say, you know what, I got to still protect my family. So you've got Cohen who's come out just today talking about, you know what, I was really lying to Congress, lying to folks when I was talking about these meetings with Trump Tower. What does his admissions now mean for Trump and this whole Mueller investigation, in your estimation?
Well, you know, who knows where this will go? Who knows what's being said? Who knows what Robert Mueller knows?
Right.
It's certainly not good. I will say this. So just based on the latest information, what we found out is that Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former attorney, admitted that he was lying to Congress about when Donald Trump or the Trump team were in talks with Russia about building a Trump Tower in Moscow. And in the past, the line had been that the talks ended in January of 2016. And now I think he's admitted it's like June or July of 2016.
Right.
So, I mean, the good news for Trump is this wouldn't prove that as president, Trump had ulterior motives for treating Putin well or for the way that he was behaving regarding Russia. But certainly you could it could suggest that some of Donald Trump's rhetoric and some of the positions he took in the primary were influenced by virtue of his business interests in Russia.
Well, yeah, I think that's an important point because a lot of folks slept on the fact, I didn't as the former RNC chairman, that the platform of the Republican National Committee had been radically, and I use that term deliberately, radically Russianized in much more favor of giving a pass to Putin and Russia and their behavior towards the Ukraine. And it just seemed kind of weird that all of a sudden now we were taking these, you know, putting, not just taking a position, but putting it in the platform. So you had that. You also had, you know, bringing in folks who, you know, we didn't know at the time, but now it's very clear, had relationships with Russia that I think, to your point, sort of gave the president maybe some comfort that these back channel conversations could go on while he engaged in the campaign on the one hand. Others can go and sort of push through his Trump Tower Moscow deal. But I do take a little bit of a different view than you on that point. I think the president was fully engaged. This is a man who does not allow stuff to get by him, largely because he's a gossiper. He wants to know and he likes to talk about what he knows and he likes to talk about what other people know. So the idea that he was unaware of what Cohen and others were doing, Manafort were doing on his behalf, to me, just falls flat because it doesn't make sense how important that this now at that point, some 20-year effort to get a hotel casino built in Moscow by Trump, how important that was to him, that it didn't occur to him or anyone in his orbit that using the platform of a presidential run and then into the first early months of his presidency as a leverage to getting that deal done with Putin, the folks were sitting there going that they found that ethically abhorrent otherwise.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. There is no doubt that Trump is involved and has been involved for so many years in really sketchy, unethical, unseemly behavior.
Right.
And to me, it was a deal breaker. I mean, that was just one of the many things that to me were deal breakers that I didn't vote for him. But I do think, like, number one, I think a lot of people overlooked it. Like, they voted for him anyway.
Right.
It wasn't a surprise to them. They voted for him anyway. And then I think there is a question of degree. Like, will we end up having some sort of evidence that a line was crossed, that line between sketchy, unethical, unseemly stuff that we all kind of knew about versus something that is, like, egregious? And now, look, you could argue it's already egregious, but something that is very clearly in the kind of illegal camp.
I think,
or immoral.
Maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but I think so. I've looked at this Mueller thing, and I'm like, you know, what I know of Robert Mueller and what I know from the people who know him, he is worse than a dog with a bone, number one. Number two, folks forget this was the guy who walked away from the limelight to prosecute cases, criminal cases, here in D.C. because he wanted to get on the ground and understand the root of a lot of the criminal mind and the criminal behavior. And I mean, this guy, he's a student of his craft, and he's dogged and determined in it. And I just don't think he spends this kind of time and money with no there being there, number one. And number two, I think, you know, Trump thinks he's so damn smart, and he says he's smarter than everybody in the room. But I think he's getting played like a big time punk on this whole thing. And I watched today, as I'm sure you did and many folks did, listening to the president standing in front of the helicopter, which I always find to be the most insulting thing to the press. Let's find the noisiest thing on the planet we can stand in front of to hold a press conference.
In fairness, Reagan used to do that all the time.
I know. Exactly. No, I know. It was just a general comment when presidents do that. You know they don't want the presser, but okay, we'll do it in front of the helicopter. But he's out there and he goes, you know, he claims that Cohen's a weak person. You know, he was convicted with a fairly long term sentence with, you know, things unrelated to the Trump organization. What he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. And, you know, he starts going then he starts to ad lib more and more. And Mueller's just sitting there going, keep talking. I got your written responses to my questions, which were largely bullshit. Just keep talking, because you are corroborating information I already have. So when the hammer drops, it will not just land on your toe, it will land on your head. That's what I think.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, ego and narcissism are incredibly dangerous, you know?
Yep.
And what's the line that your ego is not your amigo?
Right, exactly.
And so I think that, you know, it's very possible that Donald Trump will be, if he is brought down, that it will be partly just because, you know, when you've been a rich guy for 60 or 70 years and you've kind of gotten away with things for 60 or 70 years, you would tend to think you could get away with anything.
Yeah.
If people are telling you what you want to hear, you become very susceptible. And then what happens when you like manage to become president, when everybody tells you you can't, you would tend to believe that you're bulletproof, you know, that you nothing can get you. So a lot of times I think it's, you know, ego is very dangerous.
It is. And the problem, I think, for the country is you kind of get caught up in the ego. And so I listen to people and, you know, guys like Lindsey Graham and others who at this point just kind of hold your head in shame when they open their mouths, because it's like, okay, just pick a side and stay on it. All right, just do that. But know when you do that what the impact is going to have on the party, the impact it's going to have on the country, the impact it's going to have on this presidency. And I think we all just kind of get caught up in this, and people are taking sides, and Trump likes that. He wants more people on his side than not. But that's not necessarily how we should be doing this. If there is wrongdoing, if there is, or shall I say the word, collusion, then, yeah, the proper thing for people in the Republican Party, people on the Hill, people in the FBI and other agencies that are responsible for this to do is to investigate and to flesh it out, which I guess Cohen got to a point where he just figured there were just so many pincer moves being made on him. He's looking at his daughters, he's looking at his family, and he's going, I don't want to spend, you know, 5 years, let alone 25 years, 5 minutes, let alone 5 years in prison. And it's like, let me tell you the whole story. Let me tell you the truth. You know what it reminded me of, Matt? You used to watch those crime shows where they get the suspect in the pen, in the room, in the box, right? And the detectives come in and out. And for the first 7 hours, this guy is like, F you, F you. I don't know what you're talking about. I wasn't there, right? And then about hour 10, he's like, can I have a cup of coffee? And then about hour 15, he's like, what I said before may not be exactly how everything went down. And 24 hours, 36 hours later, he's like, okay, give me the pad and paper and let me just write the whole thing out. That's my sense with Cohen. He just got to the point like,
yeah,
give me the pad and paper.
You never know who the people are.
Right.
Who are going to break and flip. And I mean, this guy, Michael Cohen, just strikes me as the kind of guy who saw Goodfellas one too many times as a kid. And he wants to be like a badass.
Right.
And
remember, he's the fixer.
Yeah, he'd take a bullet for Mr. Trump, and here he is.
And
you know?
Is.
And then there are other people like Manafort, who, again, who knows what he has said, but it seems like Manafort's gonna go to jail for the rest of his life unless Trump pardons him. The thing I wonder is, since Trump is shameless anyway, and since Trump doesn't really care what people think, why didn't he just say, I'm going to pardon, you know, Michael Cohen and you know, go down the list, Paul Manafort and Papadopoulos.
I think he's going to, you know, well, clearly Cohen has now been struck off that list. I don't think, you know, I tweeted out no pardon for you today. You know, it's just like, no, you're not getting a pardon now. But I think for these other folks, what was important in some respects about what the president tweeted out today was a particular line, a particular line that I think, you know, folks, at least for me, told me everything you needed to know about where Trump's head is on all of this. So the president tweets out, he says, by being weak, unlike other people that you watch. The thing about Donald Trump in my time in working with him and knowing him is that he can't help himself. He has to tell you what he really thinks and feels, regardless of the script in front of him, you know, the phony charade of kind of, you know, getting up there and pretending something is one way when it really isn't. At some point, he's going to come back into that space and tell you what he really thinks. In that tweet this morning, he told us what he really thought about Michael Cohen, but more importantly, about what others are doing for him. They are willing to take that bullet that Cohen isn't willing to take by lying for him, because Manafort and all the others are sitting there banking on getting a pardon. So Manafort is not looking at years in jail in his mind. He's just looking at, okay, a short-term inconvenience at some point, the president between now and the beginning of his second term, when no one can touch him, arguably, the president will pardon me. And I think that's what irritated him more about Cohen, going back to your, you know, reference to the line about taking a bullet for him, that Cohen ducked, that he was weak because he stopped protecting him. He was weak because he would not lie for Donald Trump. And that line to me said a lot about where Donald Trump's head is and how he looks at these people who are out here, whether it's Giuliani, who's out TV, lying his ass off. If I were the special prosecutor, I'd haul Giuliani in front of me so fast it'd make your head swim. But
what's so interesting too is how many of the people in Trump's orbit are like has-beens, people who were like very relevant, yeah, you know, yeah, 25 years ago or more, and then people who would have never had a shot in a normal world, right? So like Corey Lewandowski probably wouldn't have been able to manage any other presidential campaign. Like if he had tried to be Ted Cruz's campaign manager,
no, it wouldn't happen.
He would have been five layers down,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so you basically have a team of supervillains that's assembled of people who, like, in some cases, did have glory days. Like, I mean, Jerome Corsi. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a guy who I think most people in the conservative movement knew who he was and viewed him as, like, kind of a closet case, you know? Like, somebody who was probably smart, but, like, not mainstream, you know, and kind of a fringe character. And now we have people who used to be viewed as fringe characters are now kind of running the asylum.
So what do you think of the Corsi storyline? You know, this is a one-off in some respects. I mean, they just want to get him, you know, get him to plea on one little small thing. He's trying to play a little bit of hardball. And again, I think it's because whatever he knows, and folks just stop pretending that Trump's people. I mean, the fact that everybody's reporting back to Trump what they're telling this prosecutor here, the special counsel, Trump knows, or at least he thinks he knows, what's going on. And so he's dangling all this stuff in front of these guys. But Corsi, to me, to your point, intrigued me simply because he's such an outlier in the storyline, you know, as the master conspirator, conspiracy theorist, that I was just kind of surprised that his narrative popped up the way it did.
Yeah, no, again, I mean, I think it's just this weird, to me, the big story, I don't know where this is going to go. I think it's more of a sideshow, but it's how these people who are mostly forgotten, you know,
right.
These just fringe people who, you know, so I've been involved, you know, as you know, we've known each other for a while. And I remember when, say, like during the Bush years, and I wasn't like, you know, I didn't work for Bush. I was more of a conservative than a Republican even
right.
back then.
Right.
But there was a sense that there were, you know, there were mainstream conservatives. And then there were a very small percentage of people who were a little bit kooky. and these people were basically kept at arm's length. And they weren't really part of the mainstream of conservatism.
Right.
And I think Corsi had become, you know, certainly after the birther stuff had sort of joined that camp. And one of the weird things about the rise of Trump has been how, you know, people who really wouldn't have been relevant in any other scenario have resurfaced and become famous. I mean, some of them are going to go to jail, possibly.
I know.
So I'm not envious of them, but they have become very famous and relevant in this world. And, you know, people who are, whether it's shock jocks or Twitter provocateurs, are really having, you know, and even you could even say like the people on the alt-right that may have been around with or without Trump, but they certainly ended up maybe getting a boost from the Trump era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is the one thing that struck me about some of this, I mean, particularly given my limited involvement in the transition, working with Chris Christie and his team before everybody got fired. Because
and I heard, by the way, at the time that was an incredibly well-run operation.
It was.
And that Christie was actually bringing in, I mean, people were assuring me, like, you know, I know you don't like Trump, but let me just tell you, like, they're putting together a really competent, solid team of people, and Chris Christie's doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's all true. And we had just on the piece that Christie had asked me to sort of, me and Kay Cole James, who's now the head of Heritage Foundation, Heritage and all of that, and who was the former Office of Personnel Management Director under the Bush administration. So she knows government personnel, you'd think. So she, myself, and J.C. Watts were working together with Chris Christie. We had a nice long meeting, several meetings, sort of getting from Christie what he wanted, what the president wanted, the type of people that would be helpful to the administration. You'll love this part, Matt. A diverse group of people, women, African Americans, Hispanics, you know, professional public servants going back to not just Bush 43, but Bush 41, the Reagan administration, those who'd worked at all levels. And then the word comes that Jared Kushner has a stick up his ass about Chris Christie and wants him fired. And all of that went away. And there's so much that explains why you see this collection of individuals around them and around this president. It's largely because when you put people in space that are, I'm going to say it, as smart as he is, he's threatened by that. It's very clear, which is why he sort of dominates the conversation with what he knows and how much he knows when he doesn't know jack about pretty much anything. I was laughing last week when he came out with this whole thing attacking the Ninth Circuit. And my response was, just shut the hell up. You don't know the Ninth Circuit from a circuit breaker. So just, you know, just move on.
I like when he discovers things.
Yes.
Like, you know, a lot of people don't know the Ninth Circuit's a pretty liberal or whatever, you know.
Right.
A lot of people don't know.
So he surrounds himself with these people, but in the end, as we're finding out, their ability to actually serve the American people and their responsibilities, or to complete the mission, is oftentimes frustrated, which is why we've had the departures that we've had and will have, from the chief of staff to possibly the Secretary of Defense and others, because it's got to be mind-numbingly difficult to be in a room and tell someone something and they look at you as if you're speaking Greek, and then dismiss you out of hand, and go off in a tangent on a tangent that makes no sense. So this whole storyline with Mueller now, I think, again, it's almost like the cheese being backed into the corner and standing alone, because all the good people that could have been in space to help him during the transition, during the early days of the administration, and even now, aren't there. And he's surrounded by guys like Michael Cohen.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, so Michael Cohen's somebody who was with him, you know, before he was president. And then he becomes president. And I think even though he got rid of Christie, he felt the need, or people were foisted on him, people like John Kelly, people like Mike Pence, people who had some political background, people like Ryan Priebus even. So, but now it seems like as things are progressing, Trump is eventually weeding out these, whether they're military officials or experienced, you know, political people, he is weeding them out and replacing them more and more with people who are loyalists, like in the Michael Cohen
right,
variety.
Right, right. So
he's comfortable. That's where he's most comfortable, I think.
So let's do the Washington guessing game, which is always fun at this time of year, when looking at a new year, the new Congress, which we're going to talk about right after this. So when do you think Mueller drops whatever he drops, or just kind of, you know, shakes Washington up with his knowledge and information?
I don't know. I mean, remember Rudy Giuliani's like, well, they got to wrap it up before Labor Day. This has to be wrapped up before Labor Day. And then it was, you can't do anything before the elections, or, you know. All so right. they've been saying it's almost over for a year now. And I just, and even people like Mike Lee, I was just watching, I guess it was a Fox News segment with Mike Lee,
right,
saying, you know, Cohen needs, or Mueller needs to wrap this up soon. And I don't know. I mean, how many years did Bill Clinton, you know, did Ken Starr look into Bill Clinton?
That was, what, 3 years, 4 years? It was long.
That was
a long time. No. And then Benghazi. I mean, hell, I mean, Republicans are bitching about, you know, this special counsel. What about the investigations that Trey Gowdy and others were doing just on Benghazi? I mean, that produced Zippo, nada, nothing, except a lot of, you know, headlines that were screaming, but that's about it.
But the Benghazi hearing did reveal Hillary Clinton's private email
well,
server.
Well, yeah, there was that. There, that absolutely, and then that,
which
that,
is a totally different thing, but it still did, you know, lead to something that was a huge revelation. So who, you know, again, you know, we end up having Bill Clinton impeached, but it starts off as this land deal in Arkansas.
Right.
You never know where this is going to end up. But I would also say this, if, you know, people are going to say, like, if let's say that Donald Trump completely skates on this, there's no smoking gun, you can't prove collusion. Well, okay, but what if I told you that, you know, Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, was going to go to jail, his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was going to go to jail, and who knows?
And his long-term lawyer and advisor was going to go to jail, or at least try to plead himself out of jail. Yeah.
Yeah, be pardoned. That alone, you would say, is a huge scandal. And so I think what's happened is we've become desensitized to this, and this is a big deal as it is. This scandal is already an important one.
Right, right. So I think it's going to be fascinating. My bet is sometime late summer, early fall next year.
Yeah.
It's just, timing's a bitch. What can you say? It's just going to be right before the kickoff of the 2020 campaign season. But that's just the political evil genius inside of me. So let's flip the script a little bit. So my heart was broken last week after 18 months of grueling hard work, 45 days on a campaign bus, traveling around the country to fire Nancy Pelosi, only to witness this week that she's been rehired as the incoming Speaker of the House after the Democrats kicked our behinds and took what will probably amount to about 40 seats in the general election this past November. What do you think of the loss, and what does that tell you, and what should it tell all of us as Republicans / conservatives going into the next 2 years? And how do you think Pelosi will lead, and where will she lead the Democrats to?
Well, first of all, I have tremendous respect for Nancy Pelosi as a political operator.
Same here.
And of course, yeah, she gets it from Baltimore.
Yep.
You know,
nice shout out. Thank you for that. Yes. Yes, she does.
She's the real deal.
She's
tough. She's smart. And I think that she is a worthy adversary. So there's that. I think that we should, you know, on one hand, I don't think we should not go into freak out mode. I think that midterms tend to be bad for the incumbent party, the incumbent president, and they have no bearing on whether or not Trump will be reelected. But having said that, I think that it's always safer to assume that you have work to do.
Right.
And so the smart move is, if you're Bill Clinton, after you lose the 94 midterms, you figure out a way to pivot and get reelected. And so I think on one hand, it would be a mistake to freak out and to assume like this means it's all over for Republicans. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, there are some very real challenges, specifically in suburbia and specifically with, you know, college educated moms.
Right.
And you need to don't freak out, but do take it seriously.
But how do you not freak out? I mean, you make the correct point that in typical administrations where this type of a loss is maybe not the magnitude, but there is a loss, there is some shaving of the numbers for the incumbent party. Presidents, whether they're Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, or even Republican presidents like Reagan and Bush, notice to do a course correction, a self-correction, and to recognize, yeah, while this election, as much as I want to pretend, may not be a referendum on me, 2020 or the next cycle will be. And so I've got a course correct. But how can you rely on that? I mean, if I'm a House member, if I'm a Senate member, a member of the Senate, I'm sitting there looking at, what, 20 plus of my members now on the chopping block in blue states in 2020, with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, with I doubt there will be any effort to self-correct or course correct to save those seats. And what do you do?
Yeah, no, it's really tough. I think you take it seriously. So the real problem is that, and I think you've alluded to this, that Donald Trump now sucks up so much oxygen that he really dominates the news cycle, drives the news cycle, and really influences the political environment. And so if you're running for Senate or Congress or governor, less so for governor, but even governor, but if you're running for political office, even if you take it seriously, even if you hustle, even if you do all the right things, Donald Trump can blow that up by tweeting something crazy in October.
Right.
So I think that is the danger. Having said that, you know, Donald Trump won the presidency once. And I think that it's entirely plausible that Trump could win. He may even lose the popular vote again and win the Electoral College.
Oh, hell that. Oh, jeez, don't say that.
I wouldn't, again, I think it's crazy.
Oh, my God.
The idea that he could do it,
liberals, there will be bodies on the street if that. These people just go out and hang themselves. They won't know what to do with that.
But think about this. Think about this, too. The other side, what are Democrats going to do? We tend to think about how bad things are for Republicans, right. And rightly so, right. And rightly so. But how are Democrats going to act? Now, I think Nancy Pelosi is a shrewd political operator, but there's going to be a Democratic primary. And are they going to be smart enough to nominate Beto O'Rourke and, I don't know, Sherrod Brown? I don't think so.
Right.
I think they're going to nominate, you know, Michael Avenatti and Kamala Harris. And so never underestimate the Democrats' ability to do something stupid, too.
Well, that is very, very true. That is very, very true. But speaking to the shrewdness of Nancy Pelosi, one of the things that was made note of her as a difference between the way she looked at 2010 and her members who were on the chopping block because of the forced health care vote and Donald Trump demanding, for example, people show how much they love him and then attacking them, Barbara Comstock, Mia Love, Carlos Cabello.
Mia Love showed me no love.
Mia Love showed me no love.
I can't believe he said that.
Of course, it's quintessential Trump to say that. But the New York Times,
it's like slam poetry.
I know. It's like, you know,
he said something like, "I tried to embrace Barbara Comstock. She wouldn't embrace."
Right. It's like, just the imagery. Stop. Just leave it alone. But the New York Times Magazine notes that, you know, in the wake of the 2010 Obamacare vote that Pelosi was asking her members to make, and the members were complaining this could be difficult for us, that she made it clear to her caucus members that they should go, quote, do whatever it took to win, even if it meant publicly distancing themselves from her, end quote. So she was astute enough politically to understand what I'm asking you to do is going to be difficult to do. So go out there and beat the crap out of me if it means you save your seat. I'm okay with that. I get it. Donald Trump, on the other hand, looking at these candidates who are in these difficult spaces, and whoever thought Utah would be a difficult space for Mia Love, but that race for her was going to be difficult regardless anyway, just in the nature of her district. We get it. But they got no lifeline from this president. They just got derision and snark after the fact because, of course, that's what real men do. They bitch slap you when you're down and blame you for not embracing their crazy in order to save yourself.
Yeah, look, I think this is – so everyone should go read that Robert Draper piece in the New York Times Magazine, which was very – very interesting, and I think really highlights what a good leader Nancy Pelosi is, regardless of what we may think of her political philosophy. And here you have her doing what leaders do, which is to say, I'm going to sacrifice myself. If you want me to come to your district, I'll come. But if it's better for you to attack me, then do that, because it's about winning. And we've asked you to take a tough vote. And the least we can do now is cut you loose to say what you need to say to get reelected in your district. That's leadership. That's, you know, servant leadership in a sense. Donald Trump doesn't have that. And I don't think it's because he's not politically astute enough.
Right.
I think it's because of the ego. And he cannot allow other people to criticize him or say anything bad about him. Even if it were for strategic reasons that would ultimately help him, he just cannot permit that to happen. And if you do it, you don't even have to criticize him. If you just distance yourself from him in order to try to survive, he will take a personal offense to that. And I think Nancy Pelosi, if you've ever read these, I don't know if you've ever read any of these books, I'm sure you have, the whole John Maxwell's 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, or Stephen Covey's, or, you know, all these books about leadership. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is much closer to what you would find if you read these, how to win friends and influence people. I mean, Pelosi's right. much more in line with what the leadership values are than Trump is.
Well, that raises another point that I wanted to touch on with you, and that's it's sort of turning the mirror a little bit more inward and looking at the new Republican minority in the House, and the fact that you now have Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, potential Sam Rayburn here. how does this play out in terms of his working with Nancy Pelosi? The Republican caucus is much more conservative after this election than it was certainly after I elected the House, you know, helped get the 63 House seats with the Tea Party in 2010. So it's much more conservative when you look at that arc. How difficult or easy will it be for McCarthy to navigate, particularly given anything you just said about Nancy Pelosi and her political shrewdness and the world of Donald Trump, which one person indicated it would be like Nancy negotiating with Jell-O?
Yeah, no, I think that you never know how people are going to turn out, but I think that Kevin McCarthy is just going to be a rubber stamp for Donald Trump. I think that Mitch McConnell is our Nancy Pelosi. He's right. He's in the Senate. Some people like him, some people don't, but he's tough and he's effective. And that's kind of where Pelosi is. I think McCarthy is basically McCarthy's elevation is the sign that now it's not just Donald Trump's party, but now Donald Trump controls the House.
Right.
The people there are more Trumpy. The Trump critics were defeated. The people who didn't hug Trump were defeated. And then so McCarthy, I think, actually will probably have in a sense an easier time than some of the past speakers like Boehner and Ryan, because they were kind of navigating this thing where, think of Boehner. In the Boehner paradigm, he was the leadership, but he was the man. He was the establishment. Mm-hmm. And then he had to deal with people like the Freedom Caucus. And I think what's happened now with McCarthy is that the Freedom Caucus is basically done. You now have a Trump caucus, and they're in line with leadership. So McCarthy, you and I both know McCarthy is like a career politician, right. Establishment guy.
Right.
But in this new era, he's a Trump guy. And then you've got people like, you know, Jim Jordan or Tom Graves or all these guys who used to be the rabble-rousing conservatives who were for free markets. And all. Now they're Trump guys. And so I think that you're actually going to see McCarthy have an easier time. Basically, I suspect that Trump will call the shots. And if the decision is that we're going to support raising the debt ceiling, you'll see people fall in line and raise the debt ceiling. So I think it'll be an easier job. But in terms of the House having, you know, being a co-equal branch and having any sort of independence from the executive branch, I don't think you're going to see that in the next couple of years.
So just so folks know, that individual who referred to Nancy Pelosi as negotiating with Jell-O is none other than Matt Lewis in a great piece that's up at the Daily Beast. We recommend you go read it. No, it's great.
Everyone go read it. But in fairness, I believe it was Chuck Schumer who originally said that talking the truth with Trump was like negotiating
that's
with Jell-O.
Okay. I was going to try to get, you know, I'm just putting a little bit of bling on it. But no, that worked. No, you're right. But it's a great piece.
But, you know, I get credit for popularizing that statement.
Yes. It's like me and Drill Baby Drill. People just don't know. I actually coined that phrase. And everyone thinks that Sarah Palin, no, that was me. I gave the speech before she spoke, right? So. But anyway, but Nancy Pelosi is the Democrat conservatives hate to love. You got to check it out on the Daily Beast. Before we let you get out of here, Matt, this is just a little bit of housekeeping for us Republican conservatives and conservative Republicans. It really kind of dovetails on the last points you were making. And that is, so now we're in a space where Republicans are voting to increase the debt ceiling, staring about close to $1 trillion worth of deficits, let alone an additional $2 trillion plus in debt. Where is this party going, and what is its what is its soul now when it comes to those things that you have long written about and spoken about to national audiences to sort of, you know, help people understand what we believed, why we believed it, and why it was important for them to be a part of it. That's become, in my estimation, more difficult to do. You said it rightly. The Freedom Caucus is now the Trump Caucus after this election cycle. What does that mean on policy? What does that mean on substance of what Republicanism slash conservatism will be over the next 4 to 6 years?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's clearly Trump's party now, and deficits don't matter. The debt doesn't matter. I don't think Republicans care at all about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it wasn't that long ago we were hearing, if we don't tackle this debt, it's going to tackle us. And right. There has to be austerity. We have to get this under control. Barack Obama's bankrupting our children, our grandchildren. And all those lines were sort of true. I guess at some point we have to pay the bills, but it's not, nobody's talking about it today. It's not a key issue. You know, I think the conservatives are still focused on trying to grow the economy. They're focused on, you know, things like tax cuts, which I'm fine with as long as they don't grow the deficit. But that one area has just been abandoned. And part of it, too, is Donald Trump has zero interest in doing entitlement reform. I think that entitlement reform is an incredibly unpopular idea.
Right.
And yet it's the one thing that we really could do that would make a huge difference. We have to have a strong national defense for national security reasons, obviously. And I don't think we want to start throwing, you know, people who are really in need, you know, out in the cold. But if we were to do things like raise the retirement age or do means testing, these are kind of boring things and they're utterly unpopular, but they're the kind of serious things that could actually help fix this problem. And Donald Trump has zero interest. And I think in a way he keenly realized that it was a political loser to talk about.
Right. No, I think you're right about that. And I think that battle for the soul of the party that manifests itself in the policies we advocate and in the positions that we take is difficult and more problematic because of that very thing. The president is not engaged in that way. He does not care, as I've said from the very beginning, without derision or trying to demean the man. He's not a conservative. He's not a Republican. And if we start to be honest about that, then we, I think, know how to best position the party and ourselves in dealing with a lot of what he's doing. And maybe, just maybe, a leader or two will emerge that will say, no, this is where we are, Mr. President. You need to come stand with us here on these things, because these are grounding principles that are going to live longer than you, that they will surpass your time in office, and we cannot weaken them. So that's just my little soapbox moment. But I appreciate what you said, because I think it's so, so true. Matt, thank you, man. This flew by. This was a great conversation. I always enjoy talking to you. Matt Lewis, senior columnist at The Daily Beast. Like I said, check out his piece that's out a couple of days now on the site, Nancy Pelosi's The Democrat Conservatives Hate to Love. You got to check it out. But also check out his book, Too Dumb to Fall, How the GOP Went from the Party of Reagan to the Party of Trump. If you really want to get an inside understanding, Matt lays it out very well. It's a great book. I need to have you sign my copy, by the way.
Anytime.
Next time I see you, I will make sure I remember to bring it. So you could do that.
And I always
tell
people,
send it to you.
I always tell people that Too Dumb to Fail is not an autobiography, despite they may think it's a memoir. It is not.
No, it's not. No, you're too smart for that, my friend. Matt Lewis, great pleasure having you tangle it up with the Man of Steel.
All right, thank you.
All right, guys. All right, folks, so that does it for now. But you know I'm going to come back because I love you too much. The Man of Steel will be back in the house with you. But until then, you can certainly check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, all those great spots. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michael Steel. That's where I like to hang out from time to time as well. And if you stick around for just a second, I got something else I want to share with you. Hey guys, it's the holiday season, and we're all thinking about giving and sharing. Sometimes the best gift that you can give is an opportunity that could change someone's life. That's why our friends at Transatlantic Real Estate have created an investment opportunity for the everyday investor. Here's the deal. We all know that legal marijuana has created one of the fastest growing industries in this country. We also know that crowdfunding makes it easy to get in early on an investment opportunity. MarijuanaStock.org combines the two. They buy land that supports marijuana grow operations and leases it to licensed high-paying tenants, so you can invest in the landlord of a licensed marijuana farm in a high-growth market. Act now and you can participate for as little as $300 before the company goes public. Just go to MarijuanaStock.org to complete and confirm your application to participate. Don't just buy a gift this holiday season. Get an investment opportunity for someone special. To get started, go to MarijuanaStock.org. That's MarijuanaStock.org. We'll be back next time with more from the Man of Steel.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
These days, I can do anything from my phone. Book a vacation, order a meal from a five-star restaurant, buy and trade stocks. But maybe the most amazing thing I can do is make my dirty laundry disappear and then reappear perfectly washed and folded. I have Rinse to thank for that. I just schedule a pickup in the Rinse app or at Rinse.com. A Rinse valet comes to get my clothes, and before I know it, they're back, crisply folded and ready to wear. They even do dry cleaning, which is returned hanging in a nice Rinse garment bag. And with Rinse, my satisfaction is guaranteed. If for any reason I'm not happy, they'll re-clean my clothes for free. Best of all, Rinse saves me tons of time each week. That's time I get to do something I love versus something I have to do. So if you want to save loads of time by not doing loads of laundry, remember, there's an app for that. Rinse. Sign up now and get $20 off your first order at Rinse.com. That's Rinse.com.